to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we have an interesting show. We're going to continue speaking about addictions, and we're going to speak today about alcoholism and how it's something, it's a terrible disease. It does wreckage to families. We will have a Besyakover who will talk about how it wrecked her family, and we want to speak about excess drinking at Kedeshim. 12 bottles of single malts on the table with herrings, etc. And then on top of that, you have, unfortunately, in many schools, they have where there's drinking. And we're being mechanech kids from a young age to glorify alcohol, wine, different types of craft beer, etc. And it's done without boundaries. Let's talk about it from a halacha, from a hashkafa, and from a life experience point of view. We'll do all three. We have a wonderful lineup of guests. We have Rabbi Moshe Hauer from Baltimore. We have Tom Gagliano, who is Dr. Twersky, co-wrote with Dr. Twersky a book about alcoholism, about other type of dependencies. We will have a lovely young woman, Chaya, who saw how it wrecked her family. She will share with you her stories. And it's interesting, I challenge you a quiz. We have so many learned Talmidei Chachamim here. Where is the first time it talks about gullus in the Torah? Well, or the first word gullus appears? Let me put it that way. The Medrash says, it says by Noach, when Noach gets drunk, it says, Vayiskal b'toicha oil. And he rolled in the oil, whatever Vayiskal means, different Mefarshim there. But Yiskal, so the Medrash says, Vayiskal means Goram gullus loy ulabanav. He caused the destruction of his family. Gullus Leilabanov. We will hear a woman who talks about how alcohol destroyed her family, her children, herself. It's a very sad story. And following that, we will have Rabbi Yehoshua Kaganoff, who is the head of the International Congregation of Addicts in Recovery. And he's probably more knowledgeable about this than just 99.9% of Rabbanim. He's written Sfarim about it. His Sefer, by the way, will be listed as a PDF on our Mar Makaymus as fascinating stories, letters to Rabbanim, really very interesting, as well as Halacha. And he will be speaking about dependencies, both alcohol, drugs, and SA, sex addiction. And that is one of the more fascinating interviews we've had, Rabbi Yehoshua Kaganoff. He will be at the end. You know, before we begin with our guests, I would like to just mention something. You know, can you go to a church where in the basement they have either an Alcoholics Anonymous, or they have a Sexual Anonymous, Gambling Anonymous, whatever it may be, or is there a problem? Archaic. Shiloh Vanessa Daraisa, like the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. So there's a tshuva from Reb Moshe in Tshuvas van Haggis, that's Reb Moshe Sternbach, the Ravid, he's been on our program many times, and it's in Chelig Beis, in Tuf Yud, where he clearly says that it is not an issue, because he says, since you're going there for a particular reason, and usually these churches have signs, he talks about going for voting purposes, but I think this would be similar to the sign, Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever it may be, and it's used for other reasons, there would be no Isra of Harchek. We will post these Tshuvas on our Mar Makaymus as well. Now, here's an interesting thing. If you ask a clever yeshiva boy, or most clever, you know, they'll tell you, drinking, I looked through Dalet Chelkei Shulchan Aruch, there's nary a mention of it. And they would be right, because it's not mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, but it is mentioned, for example, the Gemara brings it a number of times. The Gemara, for example, in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin, talks about Tnu Shecher L'Oved V'Yayin L'Mari Nefesh Amri B'Yitzak Al Tera Yayin Ki Yisadim. It says Ma'adim Pneim Shol Rishoyim Ba'Elam Hazeh. The Gemara brings many Mekairis about the damages of wine. Now it's interesting, the Halacha in Shulchan Aruch is not brought, the Rambam in Hilchos Deis in Parakeh brings it, and his Lashon is Kol Mishtaker, whoever gets drunk, Harei Zechaita, he's a sinner, Umaguna, and shamed, and he's derelict, right? When he says, a mishtaker b'fnei ha'me'aretz or ezechil l'Hashem. And Aram brings it again in Perek Vav of Hilchos Yomtiv. He says, ha'shikros v'aschoik v'kalos roish einei simcha el'hoilus v'simcha. Now the question is, why is it brought in Hilchos Deis as opposed to the Shulchan Aruch? And I put to you that in Hilchos Deis, there's something called derech eretz kadma l'Torah. For example, the Torah does not tell you anywhere in Halacha that you have to take a shower or bathe. Now, we understand that if somebody walks into the house and they haven't showered in 2 months. Everybody's going to run the other way, no matter who he is. They're not going to say, well, it doesn't say that in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't give us many examples of personal hygiene, and I'd leave it up to your imagination. Nor, for the matter, does the Shulchan Aruch discuss mental health at all. And that goes into the klal of Derech Eretz Kadma L'Torah. The Shulchan Aruch assumes that people will care for them, for their bodies, and they will be, you know, we're talking to normal human beings over here. It doesn't tell you what personal hygiene should be like. So that's why the Rambam brings it in Hilchos Deis, and he says, HaRezeh Chaita. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, I will post Mar Makaymus online of many other places that it is brought, but all sort of in, you know, incidentally, in Hilchos Purim it's brought, the Beis Yosef brings it. You will see 10 or 15 Mar Makaymus, but that is it. Again, it goes into the Derech Eretz Kadma L'Torah. Now, I do want to mention another thing. When we talk about all these dependencies, such as alcohol, etc., I want to tell you a varat al pi machshava, hashkafa like a view of it. You know, we're going to hear from both the psychologist and from Rabbi Kaganoff, there's a concept called a hole in your soul. And what does that mean? The next time you want to reach for that glass of schnapps, or in my case, food, carbs, when I get stressed, I go to carbs right away. What is our psyche telling us? There's something that's bothering you. There's something that's hurting you. You have a pain. The best answer could be a cheese Danish, could be shopping, it could be alcohol, it could be sex, could be pornography, could be gambling. So there's two ways to deal with it. Our body sends us an alarm. A psych sends us an alarm. You know, there's one fellow, when he gets pains in his chest, right? What does he do? He says, you know, I have codeine and Tylenol in my shelf. I'm going to take 2 codeine bottles. The pains will go away. And another guy says, you know, if my body's telling me an alarm, maybe there's something I should do about it, and runs to the emergency room. Now, the first guy feels better in 15 minutes when the codeine kicks in. I'm not sure about an hour later. The other guy doesn't feel so good, but he listened to the alarm. So the next time any of us were about to reach for those endorphins, whatever gives us that good feeling, maybe we look back and we say, wait, what's the alarm here? What hole in my soul am I trying to fill with this cheese Danish or this glass, this tumbler-sized glass of schnapps? And it's interesting, let's say the Rambam in Hilchos Tumas Tzaras, when he talks about Tzaras, he says, you know, when you get a warning sign, it's a gift from God. He says, first he gives you a nega on your bias. He says, when Klal Yisrael was b'ray my lust, when they were exalted and holy people, God would send you a warning. He would send a nega to your bias, and it would cause monetary damage to your a property you own. He said, and then it would afflict your clothing. It's closer to you. And finally, it was on you. And then you were excommunicated, etc. But we could look at the warning. It's like, I had a guy, I'm in real estate, and a fellow in the neighborhood came to me, said, you know, David, I'm building a house. I hired a builder. And it's taking months longer because the electrical inspector said, you know, the wiring isn't done right. This guy said, well, could you help me? Do you know somebody in the inspection department? And I looked at him and I said, the inspector, would you rather him tell you now there's something wrong with the wiring? Or would you rather the house finish quickly, you know nothing about it, and you're sleeping there with your 6 children, and then in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning, when there's smoke, you find out there was something wrong with the wiring? And that's what the addiction is telling us. And you know that the Rambam, these warning signs, the Rambam Lashon and Hilchos Tainis, in the beginning of Hilchos Tainis, I think it's maybe Perek Aleph, in the beginning, so it's Perek Aleph Gimel, Aleph Adalon, he says, all these Tainesim, he says, when a tzara comes on a person, they could run from it and make believe it's not and just power through it. Or he said they could grasp the warning signs and realize there's a very powerful message from that warning sign, from that time of tinus, the time of tzara, that pain in your heart, the pain in the chest, the smoke alarm, or the inspector who told you about it. Well, which ones? So Rambam says, and if you don't heed those warning signs, you know what the Rambam says? He says you're an achzari, you're an idiot, you're doing an evil to yourself and to your family. And like, let me give you something. If you not want to have no sign of trouble in your relationships, in your health, in your life, in your business, here's a very simple answer. cut the alarms off. Throw out your smoke detectors. Stop looking at the scale. Stop looking at your spouse when she or she is obviously very upset. Ignore it all, and you won't have any trouble. But that's a little bit like wetting your pants. There's a good feeling for the first 2 or 3 minutes. It's not so good afterwards, right? So I think we could look at addictions and say, rather than something terrible or this, next time you want to reach for it, say, what's the smoke detector telling us? What hole in my soul do we have to fill? And let's go to a story. We're going to bring on somebody who was a survived 9/11. He was 4 out of an office of hundreds, and he's going to tell us the importance of listening to an alarm. Here is Ari Schoenbrunn. Listen to his message.
So on September 11th of 2001, I was working for a company by the name of Cantor Fitzgerald, and we occupied the top 5 floors of Tower 1, the North Tower. On that day, through a series of coincidences, although I really call it, you know, the hand of God, Yad Hashem, I was running late. And I got to the Trade Center about 20 minutes to 9, and my office was on the 101st floor. Now, you couldn't take an elevator to go all the way up to 101. You had to take an elevator, an express to 78, and then change on the 78th floor. That was a sky lobby. It was just elevators. And I waited for an elevator to come down. The first elevator came down all the way on the right side of the lobby. I got into it, and I got up to the 78th floor. And the elevator I needed to get up to the 101st floor was all the way on the left side of the sky lobby. So I hung a left, started to walk towards that bank of elevators, when, as best as I can describe, there was an explosion. I thought a bomb had gone off in the elevator. That's how violently the building shook. The lights went out. The place filled with smoke, and I was literally thrown off my feet. And I was on the floor. I had no idea what was going on. I saw an emergency light in between two banks of elevators. So I remembered as a kid, they teach you where the smoke, you stay low to the ground, and that's what I did. And I crawled to that light, and I stood up, and I went behind the bank of elevators. I found an office there. There was a security office there. And I went in, and there was the fire warden was there, and he asked him, what are we doing? He said, I have no idea. So I went back out to the hall to see if I could find a way out. And ultimately, we were told we can get down on a staircase that was on the left side, whatever it was. And we found the staircase. It went all the way from 78 all the way down to 1, which was also another miracle, because most of the staircases only went down about 20, 30 flights, and you'd have to get out to another floor and walk around and find another staircase. This one went from 78 all the way to 1.
Were there many people who, when this bomb went off, or when the plane hit the building, just said, you know, I'm going to go back to my desk, I'm going to finish my coffee, the fire department will take care of it, who didn't heed the warning?
Yes.
Anybody on?
I definitely heard stories like that. And that's why a lot of people died, because they were told, oh, it's okay, it's safe. Or they said, you know what, I don't need to worry about it. It's only the first tower. I'm good. You know, and even so, it's like, I've got time. If I need to get out, I've got time. Not a problem.
There you have it, folks. You could listen to those warnings and live like Ari did and the other survivors. Or we can say, my body's sending me a signal, my mind is sending me, let me grab the alcohol, let me grab whatever it may be, and not face the honesty with integrity, the hole in your soul. That's the message of the Rambam in Hilchos Tainus, the Rambam in Hilchos Tzaraas. The Torah says, face the hole in your soul. Don't reach for the thing. You're not helping yourself. It could chas v'sholom lead someplace much worse.
We have on the phone with us, from Baltimore, Maryland, Harav Rav Moshe Hauer. He's the rabbi of B'nai Yaakov Shari Tzion, one of the leading Orthodox congregations in Baltimore, an erudite speaker, renowned for his hashkafa, his halacha. Welcome, Rabbi Hauer.
Thank you very much.
Rabbi Hauer, in the last, I don't know what it is, maybe 5 or 10 years, there's a phenomenon which I could say honestly I don't relate to. I feel like, you know, as I get older, I feel like the green. I used to look at my friends who had European parents who didn't understand them. I feel that way often myself. That, you know, somebody in my family was telling me they went up to a bungalow colony for Shabbos. There was a kiddush after the Simcha. And she said, many men got drunk. You know, there was Chulent and there was Schnapps, and they were drinking and drinking. And she said, not only were teenage boys were drinking, but the men, the married men, come up from the city and they get drunk. And my family member was telling me that one of the people she was by, the guy came home, the father came home, was already 1:30. He was drunk. He had eaten. So the whole week he was in the city. Shabbos, he comes up the whole afternoon. He didn't eat what his wife had. He slept, didn't spend the time with the kids. I had thought it was more of a teenage newbie of a problem. She says, it's the married men who are drinking and being mechanach the kids in drinking. You know, I'm mostly halacha person, and if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't say don't get drunk. You know, there's a Torah in Hilchos Purim that says that it's a davar magun b'yaisa, etc. He brings from the Shulah and others. But what are you? First of all, are you aware of the phenomenon? Maybe it was just I'm hearing, you know, stories from, you know, I have a friend, he's a psychologist. He says the whole world is mishug. Everybody I speak to comes to me has terrible problems. Maybe I just happen to catch an issue. Is it truly such a phenomenon that you're aware of? And what has caused it in the last like 5 or 10 years to suddenly burgeon? And three, halachically or hashkafically, how would you address this as a Meira Hira?
A halachic response, as you said, it doesn't say it in halacha, and you know, it's hard even sometimes to make a case in Nishmar to Meidl Nafshei Seichem when it's not a specific immediate act of physical damage. But it's such a disaster, and it's so contrary, so fundamentally contrary to every value of the Torah. Kedoshim Tiyu is also a mitzvah, whether it's counted amongst the Targum mitzvahs or not amongst the Targum mitzvahs, but the idea of living a proper, clean life is so fundamental. It's so destructive internally within families, as you say. You know, people are then turn around and would be surprised if their children are drinking. And you know, yes, I also feel exactly like you do. I feel like some kind of a dinosaur. The world, in some sense, is changing under us. How widespread this plague or this phenomenon is, I don't know. I have not done a study of the data. A caterer came over to me at a wedding maybe 3 years ago, and the caterer at the wedding came over at the chassan's tish at the reception before, and he picks up a shot glass and he says, "Rabbi Hauer, I want to show you this. This is an endangered species. He says, we really don't use these anymore. We now have, I think it's called a highball glass, because a shot glass is, you know, pours too little. People want to pour their drinks in bigger glasses. And, you know, it's a shift which every person in their realm, in their frame of reference, has to stand up against. You know, in our particular shul and kila, we don't. You know, we don't let it. It's not that we don't allow any schnapps, you know, in the building. It's not that, you know, we haven't made an absolute gezeira of prohibition, but a person wants to have a l'chaim, a modest l'chaim, beseder, not four l'chaims. You know, this is not our way. And when we're dealing with kind of crises that we're dealing with, our with children and teens, and you know how this has spilled over,
what's causing it?
That it's not what it's supposed to be.
What's causing it? It's a new epidemic. Like, where did this come from? What instigated it?
It's obvious, and at the same time, it would be presumptuous to make a simple declaration. We have lots of empty spaces. We have empty spaces in our lives. You know, the Rambam at the end of Hilchos Yisurei Bia, where he writes about a different struggle which people sometimes have, and he says that different things fill up a lev ponoi, an empty heart, and we need to be able to focus on bringing people a Tiras Chaim, a life which is satisfying. Relationships have to develop. People have to develop relationships in their families, chaverim, friends, and so on, where the relationship itself, the relationship with Torah and with life is in itself satisfying. And, you know, could I tell you a story of which I'm proud? Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we had once, we have an annual banquet of Malava Malka for our shul, like shuls do. And we usually, not every single time, but we usually have as a central focus, like a musical program. And we get up and dance, and we had a group that came from Eretz Yisrael once and played. And it was beautiful. It was almost a beautiful, beautiful event, and people were dancing, and the guys who were playing had the most had an amazing time. And they came over to me afterwards, and they said, "You know, Rabbi Howard, we wanted to tell you something. We never experienced a situation where people were so joyous in a dry room. You didn't serve any schnapps. You didn't serve any alcohol, and people were into it, and they were excited, and they were happy. Evidently, it can be done." And you know, we've lost the ability to internally, you know, generate the joy. You can't have an Einik Shabbos without cases of beer. I mean, I don't know. I think we can. I know we can. You know, we can have simchas. People can dance at a simcha, at a chasana. A bachram could dance at their friend's wedding without being tanked, you know, without having prepared themselves at the chasan tish. We've created a void that's getting filled by all kinds of things. You know, drinking is one of them. And there needs to be an emphasis in general, you know, communally and chinuch and the way we do things, the way our shuls live their lives, the way our yeshivas live their lives, where people are excited by what they're doing and don't need these external stimulants.
Well, what's changed? What's changed? We're not that old. I mean, what's changed in the last 10 years?
I don't think it's a 10-year change. I think it's a much longer term change, and you know, it's longer than 10 years. You know, I don't know exactly when this manifestation of it started. I believe that in itself is even, you know, more than 10 years. But there's a basic thing that has changed, which is that when you were growing up, and when I was growing up, and to a greater degree when, you know, people 10 years older than us were growing up, the act of going and spending time and learning and so on and so forth and living a frum life was in itself a little bit of a chiddush. And what you did was to some degree in itself courageous, pioneering, and therefore required some decision. It required some energy. It required some excitement about what you're doing. As soon as we've become so strong, so now doing these things is just the natural thing to do. It's like the path of least resistance. It doesn't require any energy. It doesn't require any excitement. It doesn't generate any adrenaline to do what everybody's expecting you to do. So you got to get a rush from something else. And it doesn't need to be that way. You know, if we're going to give people opportunities to find some specific meaning that's theirs, and it's not just going through the motions, so then the space in the lathe is filled. It's filled much, much, much better. And it's a broad, you know, issue of how times have moved and changed. You know, I would add, and you know, it's a small issue relative to the big one, but you know, it's something which, to some degree, is in our hands. Is we have glorified drinking, you know, something, you know, tremendous. How many varieties of wine were there, Reb David, when you grew up, when you went to the wine store to buy, you know, with your father to buy a bottle of wine? How many choices did he have?
It was Malaga or Cream Concord.
How much could he spend on a bottle? I think then that you could get like those huge Ketem jugs. You'd be able to muster spending $15 on a bottle of wine that had four bottles of wine in it. You know, nowadays you know what a person can spend on a bottle of wine, and we're in this competition. You know, someone told me about a gemach in a certain large Jewish city where a person gives people designer bottles of scotch for a kiddush. They refill the bottles with regular scotch because nobody knows the difference. But this way, a person can meet the standard and the expectations in an ir hatayra of what kind of things. Now, when you glorify, when your bottle of scotch has to come in a box with its own pillow and blanket, you know, what do you expect? What do you expect the kids to do? You know, ishkafim ahalle. People see what you what you, you know, what becomes the admired thing. And I think we have to take some of that out. Take some of that out. Now, how we're going to make a community decree? We're not in a place to do that. But we have to promote other values as primary, and the value of living a clean and healthy life, the joy of a father being able to sit around the table with his wife and children instead of being Rachmana Litzlan, you know, lying in bed with Shechrusei Shalait. You know, where's the promotion of that?
Rabbi Howe, what could we as a community, I know you're saying it comes a lot from Lev HaPanim and HaChachma, it comes from a feeling of ennui, from boredom. What could we as a community, when we were young, there weren't a lot of B'nai Torah. There was a sense of we're coming, we're going to establish Torah, we're going to become, in your case, a big Rav, in my case, a Baal HaBas who's a Lama Torah. What sense of, what mission can we give the children today who feel they're just part of an army of thousands of people wearing black and white, you know, just marching like they have a, you know, they have a number from, you know, the electric company. How do we imbue a sense of individuality, a sense of purpose, a sense of individual mission to our children today, given that Baruch Hashem, because of, you know, Rav Shef of Kav Yachal, we are Baruch Hashem and now in Eidah, we're a Kehillah. How do we give them a sense of mission again?
This is the fundamental job of parents. It's the fundamental job of Rebbeim, it's the fundamental job of Rabbonim, that every person in their circle, and again, the parents is really the absolutely, absolutely most fundamental and basic place for it to start, is to be able to enhance the sense of individual worth and value of each person, that a child, as he grows and develops, should understand his specific kaychas, right? Remember Rav Yechon ben Zakkai in Pirkei Avos with his five talmidim. He let them know exactly what distinguished them, what made their specific qualities, what made those known. Exactly, and to nurture within each person ambition, to make sure that children are ambitious, that they're going to accomplish something. Ambitious, it comes at every stage of life with its own particular ambition, but if they're just going through the motions, punching the clock, where is excitement supposed to come from? But if they set for themselves some particular goal, and if they set for themselves a goal which is their sipuk, which is mokam shalibo chafetz, which is something which they specifically flourish in being able to do, something which they enjoy doing and which they do well, which are the two critical pieces that a person has to identify within themselves, to find their yechidus, to find their uniqueness. You know, that's the most invaluable gift. It's the most invaluable gift. Now, sometimes our institutions are themselves overburdened. You have, you know, very large institutions with all these cost discussions that get over and over again. People go to yeshivas and with shiurim with many, many hundreds of talmidim, and sometimes because they're the most wonderful shiurim and the most wonderful yeshivas, but it's muvan me'elav. It's self-understood in a situation like that that they're not going to be able to get the individual tipul from the Rebbe, and so we as parents have to make sure either we're providing it ourselves or we're finding someone who's going to make sure in the life of our child that our child's individual kaiches are nurtured and that he develops ambitions, because ambitions breed passion and excitement.
Rabbi Sai, this is the wise Paisik and Talmud Chacham and Rav from Baltimore. Rabbi Moshe Howe, it was an honor to have you on with us.
Thank you, Rav David. I hope that our discussions are l'tayla.
Cultiv. Our next guest is going to be Chaya. She's a survivor, barely, of a family that disintegrated because of alcoholism. Listen to the damages. So before the next time you want to put out, you know, watch people get stoned in your bungalow colony, at your kiddush, wherever it may be, on Purim, let's take this woman's heart's words. I've been guilty of this too. I've also seen teenage kids in my house on Purim drink too much. It's not happening again. Listen to Chaya's story. We have on the phone with us Chaya, who has a very, I think, important story to share with us. Welcome, Chaya.
Hi.
Can you share with us your story and your experiences with alcohol?
Yeah. So when I first got married, my husband was not, he wasn't so into it. I think it came about after a couple of years. I think it started with my son's kiddush. And I'm sorry, my son's Shom Zachar. And it continued on. Like, at first I didn't really pay attention. It was like, okay, he'll have something at the table for Shabbos, and he started to invest in more things, and he, like, used the word connoisseur a lot, which I think was the beginning of the fact that I didn't really recognize it for what it was. It was just like, okay, he's into it. It's a habit. It's a hobby. It's, like, something he does for fun, and he like, prided himself on knowing all these fancy names, all the single malts and things like that.
Do you come from a normal, like, sort of a Orthodox Beis Yaakov background? I mean, I don't know who you are, so I'm just asking, just to give us a sense.
Yeah, I do. I come from a regular Beis Yaakov background, but my ex is a Baal Teshuva. So,
did you have any background, like, you know, had you grown up with kiddush and wine on the table? Like,
no. So in my father never drank. Like, he made kiddush on either grape juice or, like, something very light. But never, it was never a thing. Like, he never just, like, killed with a glass of wine. He was not that type. And my brothers also, generally speaking, they weren't so into it. You know, like, I don't think it was as much of a thing back then as it is now, but they weren't so into it. And I grew up with them in their teenage years, and they didn't get, like, stoned or trashed or anything like that. So it was a pretty new concept for me. And as things progressed, and it got like, little by little, it got worse and worse. It would start at the Shabbos table, and it would eventually kind of cross over into, like, other times during Shabbos, and then eventually it was, like, weeknights.
Now, was he violent when he was drunk? Did he do anything, or he just slept?
Very rarely he got violent, but it's pretty horrifying to watch a grown man get violent and be out of control and not in control of himself. It's terrifying, because that's not who. First of all, a grown man is strong, and when they're drunk, they, like, they can't control their movements, and they just kind of, like, flail around, and they don't know what they're doing, and it's terrifying, because they don't know their next move. They could, like, you know, throw something, lash out. For the kids to be around and see that is life altering. It's something that they will never be able to unsee. And Baruch Hashem, like, it didn't really happen so often. But
did he ever strike the kids or do anything to the kids?
No, not well. He would yell at them, but he wouldn't hit them. But he would throw things. So that when that happened, again, it didn't happen often. But when it did happen, maybe 10 times it happened, but it got...
What would he throw?
Like, whatever was around. Like, a plate off the table, a glass, a picture frame, whatever he got his hands on. And, you know, he had strength, so it would have momentum, and I didn't know if it was going to hit. My first priority was getting my kids out of that room. And usually, though, the usual course of his drinking habit was that he would kind of start the table on Shabbos. This was like, he would start at the table, end up on the couch, make his way to bed, and, like, sleep through the rest of Shabbos pretty much till Havdalah. Sometimes I would make Havdalah myself. Other times he would manage to wake up in time, especially in the summer. He had time to sleep it off, so he would make Havdalah. During the week, at the worst point, he would just be drinking all night and then sleep all day.
And did he have a job?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he had his own business, but he kind of ran it into the ground. So he wouldn't go to any clients because he wouldn't be able to. This was at the worst point in my marriage, and he wouldn't be able to move. He would just sleep till 2 or 3 in the afternoon and then get up and start the entire process all over again.
And did you go to bungalow colonies? I mean, did he drink at Kedashim? Was it bungalow colonies? Was it in public,
yeah, so,
or just in private?
Right. So when we would go away, he would, you know, of course, like, shul, he would go to shul probably just to, like, go to the kiddush. And if there was a shalom zachar while we were away, he would go. And also in town, like, he would do the same thing. And he would make it a priority to, like, you know, to go to this, to whatever it was, either shalom zachar or kiddush or whatever. He would just go and see what there was to drink there. And mostly he was happy just, like, kind of drinking by himself. Like, he would just, like, closet himself away and just, like, you know, be in his office and drink. But he, whenever he was out, he was definitely drinking, like, on Shabbos and Yontif.
And do you think this was encouraged, like, by his friends? Like, what brought it on? Like, what catalyst would you say, if we could take that moment away? Is this anything like that?
I think it was a combination of things. It genuinely started out as a hobby, whatever that means, an interest in it. Maybe he felt it was, like, cool, you know, going to a kiddush. Maybe it was, like, a talking point, or it started out as something like that. But I think it crossed over into a real addiction, and he really couldn't stop, and it completely overtook his life, and it took priority over everything and anything. And, I mean, over family, over business responsibilities, over family responsibilities, paying bills, paying the mortgage, and things like, you know, there were other addictions as well, but alcohol was the most prevalent. And it basically, alcohol was the main star of, like, why my marriage was destroyed. That was the most prominent addiction, and it was something that it took me. It had such an impact on my life that it took me years to even walk past a wine store. Like, if I had to go somewhere, if I was in a plaza and there was a wine store there, I would drive from one store to another so I wouldn't have to walk past it. And that's pretty extreme. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, I got to a point where I was able to get over it and even, you know, go into a store now and buy what I need for Yontif. But it completely changed my life. And I had a pretty good attitude towards alcohol in general when I was growing up. My family didn't abuse it. I didn't know anyone who was an alcoholic, so I had no baseline to go against. Like, there was no such thing. Like, I didn't know anyone, so this was a completely new experience for me. And in that regard, I like, it was almost like living a double life. Like, how it impacted me in my day-to-day life was that I had to, like, pretend like everything was fine, like this was my new normal. So I had to go along with it and pretend like it's totally fine that my husband was sleeping all day and not making any money. And I had a part-time job, which helped pay for maybe a couple grocery orders a month or whatever. Well, it wasn't very much, but it was something, but it wasn't enough to live off of. And I had to, like, kind of pretend that this was normal to live a life like this. And I had to put up a front and a face, and it was completely exhausting. And I had no idea how I was going to live next week. I was just trying to get through the next hour.
When you were dating, did you see anything that would give you an indication that he could become an addict?
No, there was absolutely no sign of it. And even in, like, my first year or two of marriage, it wasn't even like there was no clue that it would be such a thing. I know that his own father is an alcoholic, but he had absolutely no substance abuse when we got married, and well into, like, maybe I would say, like, 2 years of our marriage, he was totally not drinking at all. Like, we'll make it in some grape juice, maybe wine once in a while, but it wasn't even a thing.
Do you think he had some internal wound that caused this?
I think he happened to have had a horrible childhood, and he was very scarred from that. And he never got over things in his childhood. his own parents got divorced, and he was very hurt by it, and he never really got over it. I don't know if he actually used alcohol as a way to cope with his past. I mean, it could be, but once he got into it, I don't think it mattered why. I think that the fact was that it was there, and he wasn't. The difference between him and somebody who's a recovered alcoholic is that they recognized that there was a problem, and that was step one. And my ex, unfortunately, at that point, he didn't even acknowledge that there was a problem. He didn't think that there was anything wrong with what he was doing.
What did the Rabbanim say along the way of this? I mean, this sounds like a 15-year journey. What did they say?
My own Rav said, like, whoever it was, like he said at the time, like, go for help, okay? Like, that was basically their involvement. They said, as long as you're seeking professional help. And, you know, we did, but that was it. When it got to its absolute worst point, that's when I've always, like, sought that Torah to guide me through these issues. And they, unbeknownst to me, my neighbors and my friends went to Matisyahu, and they said to him, what do we do? This is a situation. She's in a terrible state. Like, what should we do? And he said, if you tell her to get divorced, she will hate you forever. She has to come to the decision on her own. You can't tell her what to do. And Baruch Hashem, later that year, I finally was able to see it for what it was, and that's when I asked for a divorce.
Is there like one or two moments that you felt like that really painful moments during this journey or embarrassing? Like, share with us, because I want the next time somebody puts out by a kiddush, you know, 10 bottles of scotch, single malts, and you have teenage boys and married men piling up and not taking a schnapps glass, but taking like a water glass to fill it up. Share with some of the pain that they can be causing on the future spouses or children of these people.
There were a few really embarrassing moments. I mentioned that because of my husband's addiction, that he was not able to pay a lot of the bills in the house. And, you know, my story is kind of extreme, but I guess it'll help to illustrate the point even better. My car was actually repossessed in the middle of my neighborhood on a very sunny summer day when everybody's kid was out and they were all watching, and of course you had like 10,000 kids on the block coming to see the tow truck. And the guy was not like being quiet about it. He was just like, you know, shouting the whole time, and it was so humiliating. You know, I've gotten my utility shut off one time. It was Erev Yontif that my water got shut off. It was so extreme and so awful and so humiliating. And one time, I think it was on Yontif, my husband was pretty drunk, and he started yelling at me outside. We were standing outside, and he got upset at something, so he started yelling at me in the middle of the street. And there were couples walking and families walking, and I was begging him to be quiet, and I was begging him to go inside the house, but he was completely unhinged, and he just kept screaming at me in the middle of the street. And it was right outside our house, and I'll never forget that.
What would you say to people, like, what would you advise us as a community, saying, look, I was a carbon, and here are some hanhuggis, or here are some actions that people should think very carefully of before they do?
I would say that alcohol is a drug, and it might seem like fun at first. You know, it might seem fun to, like, give out Bacharim, especially on Purim when it is glorified. And it is, you know, people say it's a mitzvah. And to be so completely drunk on Purim is one thing. And even that, I think people take it to the extreme even on Purim. But there is no excuse for giving anybody underage, even Bacharim, any alcohol whatsoever. You know, people would scoff at me and laugh at me, but I don't know. Like, I lived my life, and I've seen what happens, and it's pretty scary. Alcohol is an extremely addictive substance, and it's so easily attainable. It's not illegal. It doesn't take much for somebody to get their hands on it and to give it out, especially in yeshivas. I know that somebody just told me that her son was in a yeshiva camp and they're drinking pretty heavy, even in like a pretty serious yeshiva camp. And it might seem like it's cool to get into it because there are so many different types, and there's craft beer, and there's, you know, expensive wine, and there's expensive whiskey. And, you know, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with having a healthy attitude towards alcohol and having a glass with you know, at a suda or during, you know, a simcha or a dinner or whatever it is. But abusing it is something completely, it's so life-altering, and it's something that I think that there's really no turning back from, because when a person goes down that path and they let alcohol start consuming their life, it completely takes over, and it's easy for that to happen. And they start thinking about when they're going to get their next drink. That becomes their primary goal. And if a person is at that point and they have a family, it's going to take a lot to recover from that. And there's so much that could happen, and it could tear a family completely apart. And it takes a lot to recover from it. And not only does it take a lot to recover from it, but a person who's recovering alcoholic can never have another drink ever in their life. And that's pretty serious. And I think that if people educate themselves and really become aware of the dangers of alcohol, it'll be a lot easier for people to get a handle on it, and maybe they won't go running to a kiddush or a simcha just to get a drink, you know. And I think that's the main message that I want to relate to people, is that having a healthy attitude about alcohol is essential, and not to let it get to a point where it's ruining their life.
And do you think they talk about it enough or at all in yeshivas?
I don't know. I really can't answer that. I'm not sure. But if it's happening, then I don't think it's being given enough attention.
Is it fair to say that alcohol almost destroyed your life?
I think it's a fact that alcohol definitely helped destroy my marriage and almost destroyed my life.
Chaya, thank you. You're very brave for sharing this with us, and I hope a lot of people listen and take your words to heart.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our next guest is somebody who co-authored a book together with Dr. Twersky. Dr. Twersky has said he's my go-to person for addiction. He does private counseling, by the way. Tom Gagliano. We have on the phone with us from New Jersey a therapist, an author, a speaker, and a coach, Tom Gagliano. We got his name from our famous Rabbi Abraham J. Twersky, the world-famous, certainly in our circles, psychiatrist. And we asked him, who's the appropriate person to speak to about addiction? He spoke about Tom, and he said he actually co-authored a book with him called The Problem Was Me. So thank you very much, and nice to meet you, Tom.
Absolutely. Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Tom, our community is experiencing over the last, and it continues to rise, but I would say 5 to 10 years, a rise in the level of alcoholism. We have, you know, teenagers and married people and adults who go out, and it starts with Shabbos. It starts by the Shabbos. You know, there's a kiddush, and they roll out, you know, 10 different types of herrings and 10 different types of scotch, and a lot of people start getting drunk. It starts as teenagers, it continues into adulthood, and it brings on some type of an addiction. So I have a lot of questions, but let me start with by saying, well, is that bad? Like, you know, what's wrong with getting stoned once or twice a week? Is that a bad thing?
Because if we drink a little bit, that's okay. But when we start to drink to numb a pain, to medicate a pain, to fill a void inside of ourselves, then what happens is, what addiction is where the person thinks they're in control of the addiction. But in reality, the addiction is in control of them, and it gets worse. So we see a lot of people out there think that the problem is drinking or the problem is pornography. It's not the problem. The problem is what's going on underneath. It's a brokenness inside where drinking becomes a coping mechanism to medicate their problems. When we talk about religion, we would like our children to use religion as their coping mechanism, as their solution to life. But what happens is many times the child stops trusting people and they need something else to make them whole, to fill that void. So when we talk about addiction, addiction is not the problem, whether it's drinking or pornography or whatever it is. The problem is the brokenness inside. Most addicts, as you said earlier, start their addiction before 18. So these are coming from core beliefs. And what I wrote in my book is the real problem is the childhood messages. The messages that we receive in childhood will dictate the intimacy we have or don't have, the roles we play. So we think that the addiction to drinking, the pornography, whatever it is, to medicate our pain is the problem, and it's not. It's really what's underneath. It's the childhood messages. The messages I receive in childhood will dictate the intimacy I have or I don't have, all of the roles we play in our life. So we have to go back. That's why most addicts start their addiction by the time they're 18 years old. And look, at the end of the day, it doesn't make a difference whether it's Orthodox, Jewish, Catholic. Addiction has no prejudice. It doesn't matter. And that's because all children are egocentric. All children early on want their parents' attention. They want to know that they're number one to their parents. This is all the same mindset in all children. So whatever you put in front of the child, whether it's religion or anything, they will rebel against that, defiantly rebel against that, and not use that as their solution to medicate their pain and problems. And then when they get older, they'll find something to fill that void. That is the ultimate reason people become addicts, whether it's drinking, porn, or whatever it is because they can't trust people, and they find these other things to fill that void. And a child will rebel against anything they feel is put in front of them. And that's really the key. Because what I tell people, and I have many Orthodox Jewish clients, giving the child the message that they come first, then the child is more likely to walk towards religion on their own, as opposed to believing that they have to be religious first in order to be loved by their child. And I see this constantly.
So, Tom, let me try to sum. You're saying that the drinking, as all addiction, is about numbing pain, right?
Well, it's about medicating a pain inside or filling a void that you didn't receive in childhood. When a child feels like they're important, they come first, then they don't need something else to fill that void because there is no void. When a child feels like they have to be religious first or good first or whatever that is in order to get the love from their parents, then we call that conditional love. It's made on a condition. Healthy children grow up believing that their love is unconditional. And what does that really mean? It means a child needs to be able to express their feelings and be validated for those feelings, not to be told that their feelings are wrong or silly or don't make sense. A child that feels like they're important is a child that their feelings feel like they're important. And that's the child that won't look for alcohol or pornography or drugs or anything else to fill a void because they won't have a void. They'll feel enough inside. This is the rudiment of what creates addiction, especially that's, as we said earlier, it starts at 18 years old.
So,
or before.
Tom, let me ask you, could you think of any reason why, look, when I was growing up, I didn't see any alcoholism and I didn't see a lot of drinking. And what could have precipitated the change that it just keeps this level of drinking in schools and yeshivas and in bungalow colonies and in synagogues? What did our parenting skills change in the last 10 or 15 years? Can you try to give, would you have any insight into it?
Yes, I would. And I want to make it clear, you know, I'm not here knocking parents by no means. We all do the best we can. But even the most diligent parents, you know, when you have many, many children, let's face it, it's hard to give all of those children the time that they need to feel that they're important. It's not their fault. It's just it just comes down to reality. So what happens is some children become lost in their families. They lose a sense of self. And if they lose a sense of self, they try to find it in different areas. Now, you know, addiction is a funny thing. We see addictions as is alcoholism and porn. There are many men that are addicted to working that put work in front of other things as well. It can be, I know I did, I'm a recovering addict, where, again, one of my addictions was work, where work became too important in my life. But it was also a way of medicating my pain, distracting myself from how I felt inside. So there's, we don't realize that there's eating. People eat because they're addicted. They're not eating because they're hungry. They're eating to fill a void inside. Gambling. There's all kinds of addictions that people aren't aware of. Some choose alcohol. Of course they do. And alcohol, you get in trouble. You can't get arrested for eating too much. Certainly you could get arrested for drinking too much when you get into a car. But it's the same rudiment, the same problem underneath. It's something inside of me needs to be filled in a way where it's not a healthy way.
So what are some of the, what's the damage that alcoholism does? Like, okay, the parent maybe didn't pay enough attention, or there was some void, because we don't want to just beat up on parents here. There's some void mm-hmm. that the child has, and now he's become an alcoholic, so or has it a drinking problem, or some other, or a pornography addiction. We see, unfortunately, too much of that, too. What is the damage it does?
Well, first and foremost, the damage it does is to the individual. They don't feel good about themselves. They feel like they're letting down the people around them. They feel like they're not there for them. I tell recovering addicts, and I have many of them that come to me, that besides sobriety, the biggest piece in recovery is self-forgiveness. Can you forgive yourself? You're not a bad person. Addiction makes us make bad choices. Choices are bad, but we're not bad people. There's a big difference between the two. Do I identify myself as a defective human being, or do I realize that as long as I'm in my addiction, I'm going to hurt people? My choices are bad. So when we get back down to what we were talking about is that eventually, addiction is progressive. It doesn't get better. It gets worse. Eventually, the guy who drinks a lot is going to get picked up someday for a DWI and or the woman and could spend time in jail. Or they can't hold down a job because they can't get up in the morning to be able to be there at work. Or the family says, you know what? I'm tired of this. Get out of here. Usually, those are the three areas that get somebody to say, whoa, I may have a problem that I can't handle on my own. I may need professional help. I may need to go to other people to get help for this. Usually those are the three things. It's usually when it comes to employment, when it comes to legality, or when it comes to family. Because addiction always gets worse, never gets better. It's progressive.
So what would you tell me as a parent or any member of the community who sees, you know, a child, could be their own, or it could be a neighbor, et cetera, excessively drinking? What would you tell us? Like, how do we fix this problem?
First and foremost, it may be a problem that you can't fix. You may need to get professional help. You know, there are places that can help. You know, I deal with a place that Atlantic Recovery Center, and it's a great place because it deals with the underlying reasons of why we do what they do. They don't just put the cork in the bottle and say, stop drinking and everything's going to be hunky-dory. No. They deal with underlying reasons of why we drink. So I would tell anybody, you need professional help. Now, what happens is this. Many times, the family has to be in some form of recovery. It's not just good enough that the person that is drinking is in recovery. Because what happens is, if we don't change the family structure, look, what happens in childhood, we take a look at our parents, and we see, are they nurturing each other spiritually, mentally, physically? And when something's wrong there, we start to play roles. Some of us play people-pleaser roles, caretaker roles. Some of us are defiant. I have clients that never wear seatbelts, speed, come to sessions late. They're just very defiant against rules. So we play these roles. And sometimes the child feels like they're not good enough for the parents. And it's not the parents. Look, we're all doing the best we can. But that creates some of the roles that we play that could lead to destructive behaviors, not just addictions, but bullying, you know, in other areas as well, or acting in activities such as depression, isolation. This is what happens when we're not feeling safe in childhood. And again, it's not about bashing parents, because parents really do the best that they can. But I don't think they fully understand how the child feels growing up in that environment or what's going through their mind.
So your message to parents is, if you had to put it in three sentences, if you had to say, I want to give you a mini course in parenting, what would it be? Give it to us in four, you know, in a paragraph.
First and foremost, create a safe place where your child can share their feelings. Feelings are not right and wrong. They're not true and false. Don't tell your child how to feel. Acknowledge them, even if you don't agree with it. Acknowledge their feelings. Make them feel like their feelings matter. They will feel like they matter. First thing. Second thing, be curious with your children. Know how they feel. What's the best part of your day, the worst part of your day? Make them feel like they're important to you. Secondly. Third, if there is addiction or mental health illness involved, which is another piece we didn't touch on, and that's when the chemicals are all crazy with kids, they may need medication, who knows, but unless those things are involved, seek professional help. This may be beyond your means, and like I said, I know you love your kids. We all love our kids, but sometimes love isn't enough. We have to seek people that know about this stuff that can nurse them to health.
And you mentioned while you were speaking unconditional love, but you said, did you leave that out on purpose or as one?
No, unconditional love. I think it's part of sharing feelings. If I have allow my children to feel that their feelings matter, that's unconditional love. If I start to tell them that they have to feel the way I want them to feel, that's conditional love. So in the first piece that I said, allowing your children to feel their feelings, that was the piece that contains the unconditional love. If I validate and acknowledge my children's feelings for how they feel, that's love that's unconditional. If I want my children to feel and act the way I want them to act and feel at a young age, that's conditional love.
So in conclusion, Tom, it seems that you say there's a lot of elements in the soup, but maybe parents that are preoccupied with too many parents working.
Sure.
Families that are just too large and parents don't have time to spend with their kids. These could certainly be elements that bring children to feel a void. And most importantly, what you're saying is alcoholism or drinking doesn't just happen in a void. It doesn't just one day a kid goes to a kiddish.
Right.
You know, picks up some
very good
thing
day.
And
yep.
Then gets stoned. It's the culmination. It's yes. A signal of a long series of things, of balls that were dropped along the way. Is that
well said? And that's what it is. It's the pieces that mount up. And then when that child becomes a teenager and the handcuffs are off, they get their driver's license, they're free to do what they want to do. Okay, let me tell you in a nutshell, people generally do what they want to do, not what they need to do. We see a lot of people out there that are addicted that need to get help and they don't get help. You know when they get help? When they want to get help. So we want children to want to be religious, not feel that they need to be religious, because if that's the piece, they're not going to do it. If they want it, they're going to do it. That's the difference.
Thank you very much, Tom. This was very informative. We thank you for your time.
Dave, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And our last guest, Rabbi Yeshua Kagan, has a very different way to deal with sexual addiction and other addictions. He said it's not about learning Musa. He's going to teach us about the hole in your soul. We have on the phone with us from Passaic, New Jersey, Rabbi Yeshua Kaganoff. He's a musmach of Rav Broya, of Rav Shimon Schwab, and Lahavdol ben Achaim and Achaim, the Novominska Rebbe. He's also the Rav of the International Congregation of Addicts in Recovery and Victims of Abuse. And he's also the Mechaber Sefer Yishmeru Das. Welcome, Rabbi Kaganoff.
Thank you.
Rabbi Kaganoff, we had a very wonderful mechanach from Eretz Yisrael on the phone last week. And he said that 80% of the bachrim who come to him have been nichshol at some time in pornography. Do you think that's an exaggeration?
No, not at all. It's not an exaggeration at all. Okay, now we need to define more, I guess, what it means, bachrim nichshol in pornography, exactly what that means. because just because a bacher happens to have looked once at a magazine, well, he's been nichshel in pornography. Does he have a compulsion? Does he repeat it? And all those other things, that would be a necessary question to answer before we could begin talking to him exactly what we would suggest for him to do to get better.
Okay. Now, let me ask you another question. So he suggested, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, I suggest everybody could listen to that interview, that a discussion about Kedusha, about your Shemayim, about Musa, you know, is very important. He gives a shir about it before Shoivavim. He said thousands of people come. Would you agree with that, Mahalov? Would you add on to it? As somebody who is the Rav of this international congregation, what would you say to Bachrim or to those who are maybe more seriously? He wasn't speaking about addicts. He was just speaking about Bachrim initial. What would you say to them and to addicts as an expert in this field? Give us a bit of your Chavis Das.
There's a letter in my Sefer written by a pornography addict in recovery. He wrote the letter to the menial of a local institution when the menial had programs trying to help deal with the problem of the internet pornography, et cetera, et cetera. And this pornography addict in recovery who was a Talmud of mine. I helped him get back clean and straight, et cetera, whatever you want to call it, in recovery. And I passed into Shiloh's for him, et cetera, et cetera. So he told me, Rabbi Kaganov, the Manal's got it all wrong. It ain't going to work what he's talking about. Right? So I said, well, write him a letter. He says, but I have to keep my anonymity. So I said, I'll be the go-between. Okay, so he wrote a letter. It's in my book. It's in my Sefer. It's about 6-7 pages long there in the Sefer. Basically, he outlines that this is not just a taiva. There's a disease going on here. Okay, there's a disease, and if it's not treated as such, so here we come to the next point, which he said. He says he was able to write a Sefer. He learned in the mirror in Eretz Yisrael. He said, I could have written a Sefer of Tzaddik and the Maral, and all the Sfarim, the Sefer Kodesh, about Hashkos HaZera, about not looking at, you know, Shemir Seinayim. He says, I could have written a Sefer. It made no difference, because when I got back into my dorm, right, that the pornography just drew me. He says, because it took me to get into a 12-step program, and he writes in the letter how he got there. He says, to realize it's a disease. It's a disease, and it requires a certain treatment, and just giving a Musa Shmuz. Now, this the Chaznisha writes, right? Chaznisha writes, the person has shiflus, right? He has shiflus anefesh. Musa just is worse. Instead of helping, the person who has shiflus anefesh is going to take the Musa and throw it as barbs, as arrows against other people. But it's not going to help him. Right, it's like as the fellow in the book, in my book, in the article says, it's like water off a duck's back, does nothing. Now, should he give mussar to someone who's nichshel once? Maybe. I'm not even sure in today's world that that's going to work at all, for a different reason. But you know, we can continue the conversation. You ask your questions, and I'll answer. Go ahead.
Okay. So, what do you suggest beyond learning mussar?
Okay, the first thing is, don't learn Musar, okay? Because, let me explain this, okay? This is very sensitive and nuanced here because basically, in my opinion, okay, in my experience, and that's what you're asking for, is that there are two major issues of how our chinuch operates, okay? One major issue about our chinuch is that we are always telling people what's wrong with them. From the moment they're born, it's Elul now, Elul. We're going to be a lot of Musar Shmuzin about Cheshvan HaNefesh, the Averis we did during the year, how we didn't do the mitzvahs perfectly. You know what? Any businessman who would have an accountant make a ledger and only do the calculations on the debit side of the ledger sheet, right, and not bother with the income, the assets, right, the business would fire that accountant. That's not accurate accounting. Accounting means that you have also the positive, the assets, and the liabilities. It's both. It's both. Now, the Mela, what we've done, we set up a system, is that we're always telling people how bad they are, how bad they are, how bad they are, which, of course, doesn't help a person's self-esteem, and I use that word the way Rabbi Twersky does in his writings, a feeling of self-worth that I have. I'm chashuv. I have, and I don't mean the arrogance. Because there's a very, and that Rabbi Twersky describes at length in his book called Let Us Make Man. right? It's not a lengthy book. It's a deep book where it describes the difference between kosher self-esteem and gaiva. They're not the same, okay, at all, right? The kosher self-esteem, which is what anava is, but we'll leave that at this moment for the time being. These are deep ideas, but the first, if a person grows up thinking, I'm terrible, I'm terrible, I'm terrible, you give him mussar, right? He's just going to, either it's going to make him feel worse, right? Or he's just going to bounce off of him. But either way, he feels terrible about himself. Now, in the rooms of recovery, when people come in, they call this the hole in the soul. There's a hole, there's a void. They feel like a piece of trash. Well, if a person feels like a piece of trash, I'm going to look for anything that I can to make me feel better. So the Baruch Hashem put in human beings something called endorphins. Those are chemicals. Chemicals get released when I do certain things, cause me pleasure, and make me feel better. Well, of those things, endorphins, well, there's drugs, there's alcohol, there's shopping, and there's also the sexual stimulation, pornography. Okay, now it can be a distraction because we shouldn't confuse. There's an internet addiction and then there's a pornography addiction. Two separate things. A person shouldn't confuse. They're all the same. Okay, but we're talking about the pornography here. Well, pornography, when we look at those pictures, when men look at those pictures or women look at the pictures that stimulate them, and there are women pornography addicts as well. Okay? When they do look at that, it stimulates certain chemicals that makes them feel good. So what they're doing is medicating themselves. This, that they feel terrible about themselves because of the message that the education system and the upbringing and the society is pumping at us, I feel terrible. So now I hear something that makes me feel good. So of course I'm going to go there. Why shouldn't I? Unless I come to realize that this is worse. It's not going to get me better. And my getting better is actually in a different direction. The different direction is, which I've already just used today three times on three different people, is that you are worth something. You are choshev in the eyes of the Ribono Shel Olam, right? You're not a piece of junk. And when you and now we'll come to make a cheshvan hanefesh, more importantly, let's talk about all the mitzvahs he did this year. What happens if a bacher would be told that when he traveled in the subway system of New York City, okay, and in the summertime it's the women dressed, and all the time it's the posters that are over there, and it's a big nisayon. Let's say you tell a bach, you know, every moment that you hold and don't look at it, you know what type of schar you get. Right? Gemara Bava Basra, Melech Beinecha, Tech Seinecha. You'll be able to see the Ribbono Shel Olam in the next world. Your mom should be face to face with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's a different message that the kid gets as opposed to, oh yeah, shake, it's because you looked at the pictures. If he gets a message that he's a choshev and he's earning and he's getting schar, that's a bigger motivator for him. So he won't want to look.
Think Banim. Banim atem l'Hashem aleikechem leisiskei didu. We do a lot of the leisiskei didu. We don't do enough of the banim atem l'Hashem aleikechem.
If you'd like to use that pithy remark, I'd have to think about it before I mask him to it. But it sounds, at least initially, it sounds good. Okay, that's right. We're not emphasizing at all the chashivus of each person, and that leads us into the other issue with the chinuch of chanoch hanah pidarko, that everything's a cookie cutter education as opposed to each child should be developed on his own. And then there's another piece, is that which Rav Reuven Feinstein teaches his talmidim all the time. I have four my sons and my grandson now learned by Rav Reuven. Rav Reuven says education, not legislation. If people would feel responsible, feel that they have that what they do is important, and not just negative but positive, I have a self-esteem, a kosher self-esteem, right? So I don't have to legislate to them, say, you know, the internet is usser and smartphones are usser. I don't have to do that. Educate them, tell them, listen, you know what pornography is, let me explain the halachas and this and that. And then mamela on their own, they wouldn't want to do it. And that's the best shmira. The best shmira is on my own, right? Because I want to grow and I want to be a better person. Not because there's a stick hanging over me, you know, it's usser, and you have shagits if you don't do it, or if you do it. The whole approach is flawed. Now, there are reasons why it's that way, but that's, you know, a political hot potato.
But so, Rabbi Kagan, I have two questions for you. First of all, you mentioned you have experience in this area. How much experience do you have?
All right, I've been working with addicts and addictions for 22 years. My That's right. My experience is 22 years of working with them. All right. I've counseled them. I paskin shaylos for them. I've gone to retreats with them, and what they call spiritual days. I've been to meetings, 12-step meetings.
You've done this with tens, hundreds, or thousands of. Try to give our audience, sort of.
I don't
credibility.
I don't keep records. I answer on a regular basis. I basically work with three or four people a day, maybe more. Okay, now those sometimes they come to my office. Most times it's on the telephone. All right, today I had calls from upstate New York. I had from Brooklyn. I had a call from Western Pennsylvania, from Montreal. And people, and from all, I'm not talking about any specific type. It's the whole Haredi communion. It's from all the way from the very, very, the ultra Hasidish, if I may use that word, and it's not insulting anybody. The most to the modern Orthodox, everybody in between. It's a machla medina. It goes. I believe there are about 70% of the Jewish population is addicted in one way or another. Not necessarily to point. Not necessarily pornography, but there's the shopaholics, right? And then the religiaholics who use religion, right, as a means of escaping, right, instead of dealing with the hole in the soul. That's my experience.
Rabbi Kaganoff, you self-published Yishmeru Das, and I understand that you couldn't get a publisher who would do it. Could you give us a little understanding of it? Because I think it's endemic of our communities dealing with this issue.
Okay. I call to task. First of all, I paskin many things that other rabbonim won't want to deal with. Okay, that goes by addictions. It has to be alcoholism, it has to be drug addictions, the food addiction. First of all, many, many post rabbonim don't even recognize that these are addictions. Because, you know, and then, of course, the pornography and the sex and the domestic abuse. Okay, now, I have there many things that are not conventional, right? Because as I write in the introduction to my Sefer, I said most times what the problem is here is either the person being asked doesn't have a grasp of what an addiction is, that it's a disease, and the science has proven it's a disease. There's a change in the brain chemicals of the person. It's a disease and needs to be treated as such. And would they know that? And of course they would treat it like a heart condition or like a diabetes or any other the major cancer. If they realize it's a disease, then you do the cheat them. I come ashen. Okay, I'm not coming any chidushim here because either that, or what I also have written in my book is that too often people who speak in the name of the halacha do not really have a grasp on the halacha, and that's really very controversial. Too many times, I just recently had it with a rabbi, right? He came to me with his whole cheshbon. I said, listen, according to what you're saying, answer me this question. And he couldn't. I said,
What was the conversation? Can you?
The conversation was about our addicts who are in recovery. Since most times the meetings only meet, the 12-step meetings are not, as Rabbi Tversky writes in his letter, which I published in my book, right? Why is it that the 12-step meetings are only in church basements? What's the matter? The shuls won't invite them in? He was being sarcastic, and the answer was yes. The shuls will not recognize that we have a problem because shikur is a goy. So mainly we can't have meetings for that reason, and also who may see me. So addicts in recovery, if they want to get a good 12-step meeting, which is what they need for their recovery, they have to go to meetings in church basements. So I have a tshuva written why it's allowed for them to go to a church basement to a meeting. So this
respectfully, Rabbi Kaganoff, Rabbi Yes. already had a tshuva about voting in churches, and he says that it's mutta.
Okay, that's wonderful. Okay, very good. Then why are there other rabbanim who still come to me and say it's usser? I feel pikuch nefesh, you're not allowed to go into church basements. So they're not only amaratim from what I wrote, they also don't know the tshuva from Moshe. Where are they coming from? So they're legitimate rabbonim and poskim, but either they're afraid to poskim that way because the community at large will vilify them, right? Or they're just ignorant. They don't know.
Wait. It's going into a church is not a question of pikuach nefesh.
No, the other way around.
It's not a child of avodah zara. It's just amaratus. It's the Gemara in Avodah Zarah learns it from the Pasuk of Harchek. It has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. The way the Shulchan Aruch in Kufnun Aleph and Kufnun Beis brings it, there would be no Yerek Val Yaver to enter into a church. It's a same
thing. Well, excuse me, Reb David, perhaps you should begin educating a lot of Rabbonim. There are many Rabbonim who don't know what you just said.
Yeah, it's a Mechaber in Kufnun Aleph.
Okay, so Rabbi Kaganoff wasn't Mechadish anything, and Rabbi Igor Smashis has it too. But there are Bonim who don't agree. I just had a shakla v'tai with someone who says it's also to go into a church. I say, first of all, it's pikuch nefesh for an addict. He needs it. That's his medicine. He's not going to get anywhere else. So it's pikuch nefesh. But if you dowels at mehocha, leave it alone. It's not pikuch nefesh. He's a chayla. So what's wrong with him going to the... No. Okay.
Rabbi Kaganoff, could you tell our listeners that should they want to read your, learn your seifa, which is, like you say, it's a machlos medina, and you know, knowledge is, you know, is the refua. Somebody wanted to reach out to you. It seems you accept calls. Would you be?
I do.
Would you share a number where people can reach you? 973-614-8446. And
yeah.
I think it's fair to call you the Nachshon Ben Aminadav on this topic. You are the one who has the courage to look addiction in the eye and say,
okay. I have such a letter which says states exactly what you said, but it's from some of our Haredi community won't like it. But the Orthodox Union saw my book, right? And Rabbi Ganak and Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, they wrote me a letter of approbation. They asked, and that's what they say, you know, that I'm willing, and I have done, stare it in the face, and willing to call a spade, take the bull by the horns, right? And those who need to know, find me. I'm a little bit concerned that after this interview, those who don't want me to talk will also try to find me.
Rabbi Kaganoff, you'll be Mekayim Lo Saguru Mipneish.
That's why I'm talking to you.
Everybody, this is, once again, we want to thank Rabbi Yeshua Kaganoff, who's the Rav of the International Congregation of Addicts in Recovery and Victims of Abuse. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kaganoff.
You're welcome.
This is David Lichtenstein. I hope you enjoyed our program. I hope we can all learn something from it, both personally, the next time we reach for something, or if we know somebody suffering, we can try to figure out, look at it, look at the alarms, what's the hole in the soul? Let's go to the heart of the issues, to the core, rather than putting a Band-Aid on it. I hope we're all richer because of this. David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.